York, come and share experience, strength, and hope. Rick W. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. Actually, my name is Rick Weaver, and I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor, Chris Dugan, has allowed me to give his last name because he reminds me on an ongoing basis that we're anonymous inside or outside these rooms. We're not anonymous inside this room. My sobriety date is November 17th, 1987. By God's grace, I just celebrated 26 years last month. My home group is the Elmhurst Big Book Group in New York City. We meet every Wednesday night at Elmhurst Hospital. If you're in New York City, let me know. I'd love to have you. I am incredibly, incredibly honored at the opportunity to speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Larry for inviting me to speak. I want to thank Damien for your hospitality this weekend while I was in your lovely city. I also want to say, Pearl, congratulations. 28 years. Congratulations. One day at a time. Your message is so clear. Thank you. I also want to say a very special welcome to everyone who in the room is counting days. Newcomer, brand new, coming back, brand new for the first time. I really only have one message for you, and it was the same message that I was given 26 years ago when I walked in the door, and that was, you don't ever have to drink again. I was told that when I first walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think I was in such a fog that I didn't believe it. I didn't understand it because all I knew was insanity. But that really is the only message. I love in the preamble when it says that our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. That's why I'm here. When Larry asked me, by the way, Chris Dugan is my sponsor. Johnny Harris is my grand sponsor. I had the opportunity to go for the first time to Johnny's 12-step retreat or advance or whatever he calls it. This past summer up in Palos Verdes, and I met Larry, and Larry asked me if I'd come down and speak. And he said, if you're ever going to find yourself in Southern California, I'd love to have you come speak. And I said, screw that. I'll get on a plane and come. Willing to go to any lengths. I was willing to go to any lengths whenever I was drinking. I need to be willing to go to any lengths now that I'm sober too. Primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, the what it was like part is really, really easy for me. I was a lying, cheating, stealing, thieving, whoring, throw up all over myself, and sometimes you drunk. Anyone relate? I grew up in Texas. I actually grew up in Texas, drank in Texas, got sober in Texas. I was telling Damien, we were talking last night, and it dawned on me just last night that I got sober when I was 26 years old, and I'm sober 26 years. That blows my mind. You want to talk about a miracle in this program? There is no way that this drunk should be standing here with that much time underneath my belt one day at a time. There's just no way. Except for a God of my understanding who loves me exactly the way that I am today. Like I said, I grew up in Texas, and I had that typical family dynamic where the father drank, the mother. I don't think I have the right to call anyone an alcoholic. But let me just tell you, she was powerless over alcohol. And her life was completely unmanageable. This woman... Well, anyway, I'm not going to take her inventory. What I remember about my childhood was one of the things I remember every Saturday night, my parents used to have these parties where they would bring all their friends together, and there was lots of drinking, there was lots of smoking, there was lots of dancing, and I remember those parties. I remember all of the fun. Right? In my mind, as a small child, that's what I remembered was the fun. But the thing I remembered the most was the alcohol. I remember wanting that alcohol from a very, very early age. On one particular Saturday, I was a little kid. I was probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old. And at that time, all the boys in my neighborhood were really into doing these things called building model cars. Has anyone ever built a model car, you know, with the glue and all that, right? I don't know what made me want to do it, but I saved up my allowance, and on one Saturday morning, I went down to the dime store. Just dated myself there. And I got like the coolest model car that I could find. And I brought it back home, and I spent the better part of the day working on that model car. I don't know what it was, but I wanted to do something that I had never done before. I finished it well into the evening as the party, and I realized the party was already starting. And I wanted to share with my parents what I had done. I was really proud of myself. So I remember walking into the living room. The party had already started. It was full of people, lots of smoking and drinking and alcohol. And I walked into the living room, and I saw my mother, and I walked up to her, and I tugged on her dress. And I said, "Mom, come here. I want to show you something." She's like, "What? What?" I said, "No, come here. I want to show you something." She finally gave in, and so I took her back to my bedroom, and I walked her into my bedroom, and I walked her over to my desk, and I said, "Look, see what I did." I will never forget the look of disgust and disdain on that woman's face. She raised her hand in the air, clenched her fist, and smashed that model into a million pieces, looked me straight in the face and said, "Don't ever take me away from my party again." That was the first time I ever got the message that alcohol was more important than I was. And I got that message loud and clear. I also got the message at that same time, or I remember thinking that I don't ever want to be like her. And folks, I grew up to be exactly like her, but not because I'm a bad person. I have an illness. I have an allergy. I can't speak for her, but I have an allergy. I have an illness that says I don't know how to live life on life's terms. Bill Wilson calls it a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. That's what I had. And I had that knowledge from a very, very early age. I could tell you story after story after story after story about what got me to my first drink, what happened to me once I started drinking. But I can tell you that, like so many people that I've heard so many times in the rooms, and certainly with Ryan, and Ryan, thank you for sharing your experience, Strength and Hope, tonight. I was a blackout drinker. From the moment I picked up my first drink, I was a blackout drinker. I lived in blackouts. I used to call it living behind the black wall. I worked in blackouts. I partied in blackouts. I went to family events in blackouts. And most importantly, I drove behind the wheel of a car in blackouts. It is only by God's grace that I didn't kill somebody or kill myself. Like I said, I could tell you story after story after story of why I belong here, how I paid for my seat in this room. But the thing I want to share with you the most, that is the thing that I don't ever want to forget, is my last drunk. I believe that I should never, ever forget my last drunk. I don't ever want to get so clean that I forget how dirty I used to be, right? It was a Thursday night. I was living in Dallas. It was a Thursday night, and I was at this club in Dallas called the Hideaway Lounge. What a great name for a club, especially in Dallas. Dallas breeds a lot of alcoholics. But anyway, I was at the Hideaway Lounge, and it was about 10 p.m., and I remember sitting on a bar stool, and it was one of those bars. It was kind of a small little neighborhood bar, and it was one of those bars that had a mirror on the back wall and then had all the bottles lined up. So as you're sitting at the bar, you see all the bottles, but you can see yourself in the reflection, right? Anyone? I see head shaking, yeah. You've been there. 10 o'clock was the last thing I remember. The next thing I remember, it's 2 a.m., I'm standing in the middle of my living room floor with nothing on, no clothes, except a jock strap. Now, this is where it gets fun. I have to tell the truth, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And remember at the beginning I told you whore? Yeah, okay, so there was a park a couple of blocks from where I lived, and it was one of those parks that was known for late night, let's just call them shenanigans. And at that moment, as I'm standing there, drunk out of my mind, in the middle of my living room floor, the only thing that I could think of was get to that park. I needed to feed my disease. I needed to feed my illness. I needed to feed that void that I had. And at that time in my life, the only way I knew how to do it was with sex. So I walked out my front door. I walked to my car. 2 o'clock in the morning. I walked out of my front door. I walked through my apartment complex. I got in my car. I slammed it into drive. Flew out of the parking lot. I had a lead foot when I was drunk. Came out of the parking lot, lost control as I was going out of the parking lot, ran into the curb across the street, bent the rim on the right front tire, slammed it in park, but what I heard was I heard my hubcap pop off. Now, I don't know in the middle of all of that madness why the only thing that I could think of was find the hubcap. I threw it in park. I get out, I walk around the front of the car. Now remember, I'm basically naked, right? Walk around the front of the car, and I'm looking for my, where's my hubcap? Where's my, you know how we do, right? Just like it was a movie. From out of the darkness, walking down the sidewalk, was a man coming toward me, carrying my hubcap. And he walked up to me, and he didn't say one word. He handed me my hubcap. He turned around, and he went back into the darkness. Now, I guess I had enough wherewithal to know at that moment that I wasn't going anywhere. So I threw the hubcap back in the car, and I got back in the car, and I had a flat tire and a bent rim. And so I threw it in reverse and backed it back up into the parking lot, into the parking spot that I was in, went upstairs, passed out, woke up the next morning and didn't remember a thing. As we do. As we do. I don't believe that I speak for AA as a whole, but I can tell you that my story is no different than yours. My story, while the geography may be different, the feelings of shame and guilt, what does Bill Wilson call it? Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I also love that, and I forget which chapter it's in the first 164 pages. He talks about the four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I may not have drank like you did. I may not have drank where you drank or who you drank with or how much you drank, but I can bet you money that you and I share the terror, the frustration, the bewilderment, and the despair. I am convinced that as a result of this disease, this illness, that you and I share the common denominator of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That is what got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I actually think it's really interesting that when Bill wrote the fourth step, that he didn't ask us to do an inventory of all the alcohol we drank. He didn't ask us to do an inventory of how much we drank, where we drank, who we drank with. What did he ask us to do? Take a look at and become intimately familiar with our grosser character defects. That was the beginning of me beginning to understand this is not about alcohol. It never was about alcohol. When I walked into the rooms, that's all I knew, is that my life was a mess as a result of my drinking. As a result of staying in the rooms, I have learned that it is not my drinking that is the problem, it is my thinking. How grateful am I that I was able to get that message, you know, that I have this hopeless state of mind and body that there is a solution for. There is a solution for it. That was my last drunk. So what happened? I was, at the time, I was an entertainer. I was living in Dallas, working in nightclubs. I was a singer, playing piano bars. I would, you know, the typical Larry Lounge Lizard thing. Tip me. Anyway, I was playing in a club in Dallas, and I had another. There was another guy there, was a piano player there, and he was intimately familiar with the court systems in Dallas. And he'd had like 6 DUIs at that time or something, and they told him finally that he needed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I remember one night he came up to me and he said, I have to go to AA. The courts are making me go to AA. Will you go with me? And I said, oh, sure. I'll be happy to go with you. I'm not an alcoholic, but I'll go with you. Now, I want to stop for just a moment, because for those of you who are not familiar with what that looks like, that's denial. Just in case you needed to know. So we got in the car, and we drove like 30 miles away from Dallas, because we didn't want to have anyone seeing us walking into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And we walked into the room, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. This old man, 70 if he was a day, walked up to me and he said, hi, my name is Bob and I'm an alcoholic. Are you an alcoholic? And I immediately said, no, I'm not, but he is. And you know what? Everything happens exactly like it's supposed to. I was really grateful that at the very next words out of Bob's mouth were, this is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for people who have a desire to stop drinking. What I'd like to ask you to do is to take this beginner's packet and come back and pick your friend up in an hour. And so I looked at Steve, and he nodded, and he was fine with that. So I did, and I got in the car, and I started driving around. And I ended up parking the car in a parking lot somewhere, and I looked and I saw that envelope, and I thought, you know what, let's just see what's in it. So I picked it up, and I opened it up, and inside were a bunch of AA pamphlets. Connor, the literature work you do is invaluable, invaluable. It was Connor, right? Right. I found the pamphlet that was the 44 questions. So I thought, let's take a look at this. I started reading, and 42 of 44 had my name all over them. And that was when the denial began to break. It was in that moment that no longer could I not admit that I had a problem. I had to tell the truth. So I went back and I picked him up after the meeting was over. And the next night we ended up going to a meeting that was a little closer to home. And we went for the next 6 nights. And after, on night 7, it came time for us to go to a meeting again. And Steve said, his name was Steve. Steve said, I'm not going to go. And I said, why aren't you going to go? And he said, because I can't deal with the God thing. I can't deal with this whole God thing. And I said, okay, you know, that's your choice, and you can do that. But I think I'm going to go. If you don't mind, I think I'm going to go. I'm really grateful that I continued to go, and I said yes that night and for many, many nights after that, because I'm convinced that God used Steve to get me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm still on this earth, and Steve is not. Due to this illness and due to this disease, it took his life. So I will be forever, forever grateful to Steve and to God for bringing me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and for having that denial break. So that's kind of what happened. What it's like today for me, I always like to try to kind of get through my story and get to this part, because this is the part that matters. For those of you who are brand new to the program, this is the part that counts. This is where I start doing the work. I have a life today beyond my wildest dreams. I have a life today that I was promised. I got a sponsor when I first walked in the door, and this guy was... Now, I'm a big guy. I'm like 6'5", 250, and this guy was like 6'9", black, and 300 pounds. And he sounded like Darth Vader. And he was exactly who I needed, because at that moment I was a little rebellious. I know none of you can relate to that. I was a little rebellious. I didn't really want to do what I was told to do. One of the very first things Benny did was he gave me my first big book. And I remember on the inside cover, he signed it and he said, "Don't take it that hard, Benny." Now, at the time, I didn't know what that meant. Well, I obviously know today. You know, I was beating myself up so bad for the life that I had lived prior to walking in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he could see that I was doing that. So he gave me my first big book and he gave me my first assignment. Instead of starting at the beginning, which is what I do with my sponsees today, like on page one, Alcoholics Anonymous, what he told me to do was he said, I'm going to give you this book and I want you to take it home and I want you to turn to page, and I forget what page it's on right now, but Bill's story. And I want you to read Bill's story. Let me know when you're done. Call me, set an appointment. We'll come back and we'll talk about it. I said, all right. So I did that, went home and read the story. And I called him and I said, I'm ready to talk. Went over to his apartment, and first thing he said to me when I walked in the door was, he said, so what'd you think? And I looked at him, and I was terrified to tell him the truth. But I looked at him, and I said, Benny, that was the most boring story I have ever read in my life. I have nothing, nothing in common with this man. Stockbroker, New York, married, straight. Nothing in common with this man. And Benny, having had a few more days in the program than I had at that time, thank God, he looked at me and he said, I'm going to make a suggestion that you go back and you read it again. I said, you're not listening to me. I have nothing in common with this man. And he said, this time, though, when you go back and read it again, instead of looking for the differences, I want you to look for the similarities. I said, you're not listening, Benny. He said, I'm going to bet money that if you look hard enough, you're going to see how you and Bill Wilson felt the same way. How you felt. Look for the shame. Look for the guilt. Look for the pity. Look for those ways in which Bill felt inside and see if you can relate to any of that. I did exactly as I was told, and as the promises tell us, I was amazed before I was halfway through. Before I got halfway through Bill's story, I was amazed that I was exactly like Bill Wilson. The only thing that was different was the geography. I didn't drink like he did. I didn't drink where he did. I didn't drink what he drank. I didn't drink with who he drank with. But I felt the same way he did. So it was the beginning. It was the beginning of, once again, just breaking that denial just a little bit more. I'm also incredibly grateful that Benny encouraged me to get involved in service work. Well, actually, I take that back. He said, I think that you need to get involved in service work. Now, I'm brand new to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm like, service work? What's that? And, oh, you mean I have to do something to help someone else? Not on your life. This is about me, dude. This is about me. I was one of those people that used to go to meetings, and I did this for quite a long time. I don't recommend it. But I would go to meetings, and I would take. I would go to meetings, and I would take. I would go to meetings, and I would take. I did not see the importance of me giving anything. I didn't see it. My friend John Francis, back in New York, he always says, I was loitering with the intent to recover. I love that. Today, I'm incredibly grateful that I finally woke up, and that old adage we hear all the time, that service keeps you sober. That the reason that service kept me sober was because it got me out of my head. Now remember, drinking's not my problem. Thinking is my problem. Hopeless state of mind and body. Getting out of my head long enough to be able to help someone else. Take an action. Ryan and I were talking earlier, Damien and Ryan and I were talking in the truck over here, and we were talking about how sometimes when that thinking gets in the way, just do something. Just do something. Go do something. Take an action. This is an action program. And I've had to learn that the hard way. I have been incredibly blessed to have had many service opportunities in my 26 years. I've done service at the group level. I got sober back when you could still smoke in meetings, so I was emptying ashtrays and greeting and GSRing. And I've done service at the group level. I've done service at the district level. I've done service in New York. We have another layer called the county. I'm currently at this moment, I have a 2-year commitment where I'm chairing all of the service work that happens in Queens County. 229 meetings in Queens County, and I've got about 150 GSRs that are committed and passionate about getting out of themselves long enough to give back to the still suffering alcoholic. Remember in the preamble it said our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That can be done through service work, and it can be done in a myriad of ways. I was telling Damien last night when we were talking, after when he picked me up at the airport, one of the coolest service opportunities that I've had the opportunity that's been given to me was every year in New York, the New York Intergroup, I guess that would be the equivalent to central office here or your AA office, every year they do a big fundraiser in honor of Bill Wilson's sober anniversary. And it's a big, big fundraiser. It's black tie, formal, the whole nine yards. And there's generally about 2,000 people that show up to this event in Manhattan. And I was incredibly honored to have been asked to be the closing speaker last year at Bill Wilson's 78th sober anniversary. You know, I remember standing in front of 2,000 people thinking to myself, it's not supposed to be this way. I should be dead. But because I was willing to get out of my head long enough to help another still suffering alcoholic, I was given this amazing opportunity to be of service. And you know, the interesting thing about service work is all you have to do is raise your hand. You know, there are no there's descriptions on what we do, but there's no prerequisite on your experience. You do not have to know how to do anything service work related in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. All you need to do is raise your hand. If you are out there and you are thinking, if you're looking for a way to take your sobriety just to that next level, raise your hand. I promise. And I can't guarantee a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I promise you, that's going to take your recovery to another level. One of the other incredible privileges that I've had in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is to transmit the steps. Right now, I'm sponsoring 8 people, transmitting the steps to 8 different people, both men and women. Being gay, I can do that. kind of a sidetrack around what the book says. Although Johnny Harris has something different to say about it, but he and I go rounds about it. But I love being able to transmit these 12 steps. I love being able to open the book and remember and remind myself that the first 164 pages are my design for living. They are my roadmap. They are the thing that keeps me sober. All the other literature's great. I love Language of the Heart. I love Living Sober. I love all that stuff. I even love the stories after the first 164 pages in the big book. But I'm here to tell you right now, there is only one thing that keeps this drunk sober, and it is found in the first 164 pages, because that is my basic text. That is where I learned how to stay sober one day, one minute, one week, one month at a time to get 28 years. That is exactly how I do it. I love my sponsees to death because they, about the time that I'm all up in my head, I get a phone call from a sponsee saying, wah, wah, wah. And God will speak through me. Show me the right page in the book. Because my sponsees, I'm one of those sponsors that when you call me, if you're my sponsee and you're going to call me, I'm fine with you calling me. I'm fine with you even doing this. But you better have your big book in your hand. Because by the time you get done, I'm going to ask you to open it up. Because I don't know about you, but that's where my solution is. That is where I find the answers to every one of my problems today. I I'm going to ask you a question. How many of you have a favorite part of the Big Book? It's your favorite part. It resonates with you the most. Lots of hands were raised. I have one of those. And for me, it is the chapter of Vision for You. And it just happens to be the last 163 words of the first 164 pages. It is the last three paragraphs of A Vision for You. And I love that. And I don't know, from the very first time I ever read those three paragraphs, something jumped out at me. And it just resonated with me. It's like the entire program just combined into three little paragraphs. And so what I did was I started looking at it really deeply. And kind of looking at it and so that I could better understand it, kind of like my home group. My home group's a Big Book study, and we tear the first 164 pages apart. We fully understand. We want to make sure that when you walk out that door, you understand what is in those first 164 pages. We have a dictionary at hand. We look up words. Anytime someone doesn't understand something, how many times have I sat in my home group and we'd be reading a paragraph and I'll read something and I'll go, okay, hold on. What's Bill trying to tell us here? I don't get it. I love being able to tear that apart and dig in deep. So I did the exact same thing with the last three paragraphs of A Vision for You. And I want to share it with you. Bill starts off by saying, in the reading, it says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. For me, that's the seventh step. Humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. Because for me, this is both a prayer and a promise. I believe that the pure humility that is found in the statement, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little, is an absolute truth that Bill Wilson knew the obstinate alcoholic nature. He knew exactly what we were all about. And why? Because he made these 12-step suggestions and not mandates. He knew exactly. Tell me what I'm going to have to do? Not going to happen, right? God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Now, for me, that's the first half of step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood God. What an amazing promise this is that Bill gives us. There is no way that God can disclose more to me if I am not willing to seek that God. There is no way I can be open to that message if I'm not willing to seek it on an ongoing basis. Because I get the opportunity to go deeper in my relationship with a God of my understanding when I talk to God through prayer and when I listen to God through meditation. I talk to God through prayer and I listen to God through meditation. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I had a really difficult time with the concept of meditation when I walked into the rooms. I thought it was this whole, and the reality is it can be that, or it can just being still, just being still. I loved keeping the whole concept of step 11 just as simple as possible. I know how to pray today. I know how to meditate. I know how to talk to God. I know how to listen to God. He goes on to say, God can't disclose, ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. Now, that's the second half of step 11 for me. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. This is an action. Every single morning. Now, for a long time when I got sober, I asked God, as the book tells us, ask God to keep me sober for that day. My prayer in the morning has been altered just a little bit. I pray for God to help me be of maximum service to him today and to my fellows. Because my belief is that if I am being of maximum service to God and to my fellows, the whole keeping me sober thing is going to take care of itself. Right? I'm going to stay sober as a result of me trying to be of maximum service to my God. And the more that I am willing to be of maximum service to God, the less I am apt to want to be of service to my disease. Right? He goes on to say, the answers will come if your own house is in order. Now, think about that. The answers will come if your own house is in order. What step is that?
Four. It is step four.
It's all about the inventory process. I cannot know what needs to be in order in my life if I'm not willing to take a look at where the problems lie. I have got to be willing to take a look at what is the truth about me. You know, in six, we become entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and then seven, we ask him to remove them. I can't know what to do in six and seven unless I have done four. And then let someone listen to it in five. These steps are in order for a reason, guys. They're in order for a reason. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. For me, this is step 10. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Here's another warning. There's no way I could ever hope to be of maximum service to God if I am not completely aware of all of those areas that I need to grow in. And that I am able to admit that I'm wrong when I'm wrong, and promptly admit when I am wrong. There's no way that I could do that unless I'm willing to go there. See to it, he goes on to say, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I believe that this is a rockin' promise because Bill promises us great events will come to pass if my relationship with him is right. Not if I do good things. Not if I show up to 150 meetings in a month. Not if I'm sponsoring 150 people. Service work is great, guys, but it is not the program. I think one of the big, and this is something I actually learned from Johnny, I think that in Alcoholics Anonymous today there is a big, big misnomer happening that these meetings are the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That this, you know, you don't have the slogans on the wall, thank God. But the slogans that we see in so many meetings, things that we hear, that we tell newcomers so often, 90 meetings in 90 days, no relationships in the first year. Mark my words, that is not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the fellowship. Those are the suggestions found in the fellowship. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous lives on 164 pages, and that's it. And if you really want to have your mind blown, go look in those first 164 pages and see how many times it talks about sponsorship. Zero. Sponsorship is another. Now, guys, don't get me wrong. I am not downing any of those things because all of those things have been crucial and pivotal to my recovery. But they are not the program. They are suggestions found within the fellowship. He goes on to say, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. For me, that's step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. You know, I don't know about you, but I totally get the concept of abandoning myself to something. Because before I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I abandoned myself to alcohol every single day. A lot of other things too, but this is a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I abandoned myself to alcohol just like it was my God. And all I'm asked today, through these simple steps, I am only asked to abandon myself to them. And you know, I'm also one of those people that believes this is not hard. Now, you may say to yourself, but you got 26 years. I believe that it's only hard if I make it hard. I really get frustrated when I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I hear people talking about them fearing the fourth step and being afraid of taking their fourth step. And, oh my God, the fourth step is so hard. And I'm here to tell you the fourth step can be one of the easiest things you ever do. All it is just writing down what you already know. That's it. Just write it down. Just get it out. I've got a sponsee right now who is, let's just call it laboring his fourth step. He's had it for about a month now, and he keeps calling me. He's like, I'm working on it. I'm like, just do it. The reason that this step is so important is because it's where the freedom begins. It is where I begin to get that out of me, and I get to let it go. He goes on to say, clear away the wreckage of your past. Steps 8 and 9, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Here's another action. You know, one of the things that I had to learn, one of the hardest lessons that I had to learn in step 8 and 9 was that it is not, step 9, the action of what we did in step 8, is not about me getting in the good graces of those people that I've wronged. It is not about me trying to make them like me again. It's not about that. If you look really, really close at step 9, there is one founding principle in step 9, and that is willingness. It is just about my willingness to be able to do the work, take the action, and leave the results up to my higher power. You know, how many times have I sat, and I've done it, how many times have I sat there and done my eighth and ninth step, or done written my eighth step and then started making my amends in 9, and with all the best intentions, I am going out and, you know, I just want to let you know that I'm really sorry for what I've done to you, and sometimes I get it back in my face that is like, yeah, you were a, and I promise I'm trying not to cuss. You were a butt. That's better than the A word. And of course, me being who I am, and I have a disease of hopelessness and helplessness, what was my immediate reaction? I wanted to point out where they were wrong. I wanted to point out where you were wrong, when forgetting that this is about me talking about me and where I was wrong. It is not about me showing you where you're wrong. It is about me cleaning away the wreckage of my past. It is about me cleaning up my side of the street. And that is it. And being willing to allow God to take care of the results. I either have faith or I don't. I learned a long time ago that there is really, truly, and this is just my personal opinion, and if you don't like it, throw it in the garbage. But I really believe there are only two foundation emotions in this world, faith and fear, or love and fear, faith being a derivative of love. I either am in faith in a power greater than myself, or I am in fear of my life and this world and my ego. I'm either in fear or I'm in faith. I believe that universal law does not allow faith and fear to exist in the same moment at the exact same time. I don't believe it's possible. One or the other. And if I am focused on fear, I am not focused on a power greater than myself. If I am not focused, if I am in faith, then I have no fear. They can't live there at the exact same time. Bill also says in the reading, he says, give freely of what you find and join us. Well, that's step 12. You know, remember, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Bill tells us, guys, this is an action. This is an action program. And right here, Bill tells us, give freely. Give freely without expectation of return. When was the last time you gave freely without expectation of return? When was the last time you ever did something anonymously for someone? Try that sometime. That'll work. That'll work step 12 for you in a heartbeat. When I had my spiritual experience, and I'm very, very lucky that I've had multiple spiritual experiences in my 26 years. I came into the program with a religious background. I was very active in a church, and I'm very grateful that I have a very completely different understanding of God today. I kind of left that behind. Some people leave it behind. They get in the program and find their new relationship with a God, and then they go back to it. I have chosen not to go back to it, but you know, it doesn't make me any better or worse than them. But what I love about my spiritual experience is that I finally, and it's only been within the last 5 years that I really truly understand Bill Wilson's definition of what a spiritual experience it is. And of course he put it in the book, in the appendix. And the definition of a spiritual experience in the top paragraph says, a personality change sufficient for me to recover from alcoholism. He didn't talk about God. In the definition of a spiritual experience, God is not there. Now, if you read down the page, it's there, and it does eventually get to it. But the real definition, as he gave it to us, has nothing to do with God. It has to do with my willingness to allow a shift in my life to occur that is sufficient for me to recover from this hopeless state of mind and body, or seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Right? When I was able to really have that personality change sufficient, I was finally able to understand that part of the St. Francis prayer it's in the giving that I receive. It is in the giving that I receive. And I don't want anything back. I don't need you to give me anything. He closes the reading with, "We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge," I love that word, "trudge the road of happy destiny." What a wonderful promise Bill closes with here. Because in this sentence, he tells us we're not alone. And we don't ever have to be alone again. I will, as long as I'm willing to do this program, as long as I'm willing to work these steps, as long as I'm willing to take the action that I need to, I'm going to have you by my side, supporting me and loving me the entire way. Now, here's another thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, how many times have we heard that we're a group of people that normally would not mix, right? There's a lot of you out here that I wouldn't mix with. That's on me. That's not on you, just so you know. I am so grateful for this program today because I love each and every one of you. You are the ones that have given me my life. You are the ones who have showed me that this is the only way. Now, Bill Wilson also tells us, and he tells us in many of his writings, that we do not, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we do not have the corner on God. And we don't have the corner on recovery. But we do have a way that works. We do have a way that works if you're willing to do the work. I was telling Ryan before the meeting started, we were talking about this piece and this piece of the reading and trudging the road of happy destiny. How many of you actually know the definition of the word trudge? Who can tell me?
To walk with purpose.
To walk with purpose. So let me read that sentence again with the definition. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you walk with purpose the road of happy destiny. How beautiful is that, right? I'd like to close with this. I heard once that the artist Michelangelo was asked once how he made and created his perfect statues. And he said that he believed that the statues were already there inside the slab of marble, that God had created the statues before he ever touched that slab of marble. His job, as he saw it, was to take his hammer and chisel away all of the excess to get to that perfection that was already inside that marble. Guys, it is no different for this drunk. My job today is to chisel away and get all of the layers of fear, frustration, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, to get all of that away through the working of these steps to allow God to do his work in my life. As a result of my willingness to do that, as I said earlier, I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And to the newcomer, as I told you in the beginning, you don't ever have to drink again. I can't guarantee you many things in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I can guarantee you this. Alcoholics Anonymous did not or may not have opened up the gates of heaven to let me in, but it damn sure opened up the gates of hell to let me out. Thank you.